Missoula police recommend no charges be filed in the February avalanche that killed a Missoula resident. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about a new economic development initiative released by the governor's office. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with a bear biologist about springtime bear behavior. The missing police department recommends, and the city attorney agrees, that no charges be brought against a snowboarder and three sledders who were recreating on Mount Jumbo in late February when an avalanche tore down the mountain, burying three people and killing one. City Attorney Jim Nugent says the snowboarder and sledders, ages 13 to 26, had hiked through the snow up Mount Jumbo, but the police believe it was the snowboarder who triggered the avalanche.
Apparently, the sledders had moved further up towards the upper end of the Rattlesnake Valley by several hundred feet and were not in the area of the avalanche. And it appears that it was only the snowboarder that was in that particular area where the avalanche commenced, according to the police report.
Mount Jumbo was closed to the public at the time, but the police report says none of the young people on the mountain knew about the closure.
Where they entered the mountain and accessed the mountain and the route that they described as taking, they wouldn't have seen any signage, and the Parks Department basically confirmed that with the police as part of the investigation, that if they took the route they described, they would not have seen any signage. And even if they had passed some signage, the reports from the Montana Avalanche Center as well as from the police investigation are that the signage probably was covered with snow because of the blowing snow and the weather conditions that we're experiencing.
Nugent says the city concurs with the police that there is not enough evidence to file any criminal charges.
And in other news from around the state, Governor Steve Bullock has released a major economic development initiative which will guide his administration's approach to growing jobs and raising wages. The governor's office has been working on the Main Street Montana project for almost a year, holding roundtable discussions around the state led by some top business leaders. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us the governor describes the plan as a bottom-up method for growing the state economy.
About 150 people work at the Boeing plant in Helena, operating machines, milling long pieces of titanium, parts for Boeing airplanes.
I think it's a great example of a vibrant business in Montana.
Governor Steve Bullock announces his new economic development platform from a podium in the middle of this cavernous industrial space. That platform, it's called the Main Street Montana Project Business Plan. Joining the governor are the two business leaders he tasked to lead the effort, CEO of the Washington Companies, Larry Simpkins, and the chairman and CEO of D.A. Davidson Companies, Bill Johnstone. Simpkins says Bullock did not want a government document which would sit unused on a shelf.
But rather, he wanted concrete steps that he and his administration, working with the private sector and labor leaders from throughout the state, could make a real difference in Montana's economy.
They say about 1,000 Montanans participated in roundtable discussions held throughout the state over the last year. Discussions seeking to tease out Montana's economic strengths and its challenges. Another 2,000 people filled out surveys.
Whether you live in Ekalaka, Hamilton, Libby, Sydney, or somewhere in between, you had your voice in this process.
It's a process and plan modeled after similar efforts in other states, particularly Colorado. Montana's nearly 100-page plan identifies economic objectives across five different regions of the state, and those objectives fall under five main principles, such as marketing the Montana brand more effectively, creating a friendlier business climate, or training and educating a workforce which is prepared for the jobs of tomorrow.
No matter where we were, education seemed to bubble up to the top.
Both Simpkins and D.A. Davidson CEO Bill Johnstone say they got involved with the Main Street Montana project because they had assurances it would be nonpartisan. Johnstone says they wanted all ideas on the table.
The commitment to respect and collaboration instead of conflict is absolutely critical as we move from the planning stage to implementing this plan.
Putting the plan into action happens in a number of different ways. Shortly before the press conference, Governor Bullock signed an executive order
directing all state agencies to assist in the implementation of the plan.
So that's some of it. The project identified 11 key industries through the process, from energy and infrastructure to healthcare to agriculture to tourism. Bill Johnstone says leaders in those industries will be brought in to form networks to find ways to work on more of the objectives.
They'll be the folks who refine and set timelines for accomplishing the tasks laid out in this plan and who help drive their completion.
And through that process, organizers will draft legislation. Bullock administration officials say some bills will be brought before lawmakers next January, but the major efforts will likely not be fully crafted until the 2017 legislature. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
You can find a link to the full Main Street Montana Project business plan on our website, mtpr.org.
A Butte man who was reported missing in February is under investigation after more than $175,000 went missing from the Sheet Metal Workers Union in Helena. The Montana Standard obtained documents indicating union business manager Jim Ryan was to meet with union officials on February 19th, the day he disappeared. His car was found at a Homestake Pass trailhead where officials believe he went for a run. Lewis and Clark County Sheriff Leo Dutton confirmed the embezzlement investigation today. A letter sent to union members on March 27th alleges Ryan took money over a period of several years by taking cash advances without explanation, selling union cars without depositing the money into the proper accounts, writing checks to himself, and making questionable credit card transactions.
A coalition of Missoula agencies called the Intervention in Action Project is working to reduce sexual assault in the community through education and training. The coalition includes City-County Relationship Violence Services, the University of Montana, and the YWCA. YWCA Communications Coordinator Amanda Opitz says the training includes the Make Your Move campaign, which promotes bystander intervention.
So rather than focusing on the victim or the perpetrator, trying to look at the culture that supports sexual assault and giving people tools and resources to try and step in and intervene.
Opitz says the training includes tips on how to intervene without being confrontational and without putting yourself or someone else in danger.
Being able to walk up to someone who might be a potential victim and saying, hey, are you okay? Being able to, as a friend, stepping in and saying, hey, you know, I need your help with something, come over here, and, you know, moving them away from a potentially dangerous situation.
On April 14th, the project will provide what's called Sexual Assault Free Establishment, or SAFE training, to bartenders, servers, and security staff at Missoula's Rhino Bar. Opitz says they will learn how to identify predator behavior and how to intervene to stop it.
What we know statistically is that alcohol is, bar none, you know, the most widely used date rape drug. And that doesn't necessarily, like I said, mean that it's a cause of rape, but it means that predators use alcohol as a tool to, you know, make their victim less credible, more vulnerable, and less likely to report.
The project hopes the safe training at the Rhino Bar can eventually be repeated at other bars around Missoula.
Using dance and movement to teach concepts like conduction, convection, and radiation is the goal behind a co-motion dance project about fire ecology. The project is based out of the University of Montana and brings dance into the classroom as a teaching tool. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry is among an audience of more than 400 elementary-age students watching and participating in a recent performance in Whitefish.
Put it up, put it up, you only put it up.
Lightning has struck and ignited a tree as two dancers of the Co-Motion Dance Project play the role of campers who grab a bucket of water to put it out. We'll get to the conduction and convection later. Soon after the campers douse the flames, they're joined by a scientist, and they, and the audience, learn that fire is not all bad, and that it plays a role in the natural cycle of the woods.
Rip-roaring treetop fires burn bright and hot.
Lodgepole pines love this kind of fire. They make a special kind of cone, which needs fire to open. These serotonous cones are sealed in a waxy resin, which melts away in a hot fire.
Blackfeet singer-songwriter Jack Gladstone and his niece, actress Lily Gladstone, narrate parts of the performance, bringing in the story of how Native peoples used fire.
Fire belongs here. It ran free across this land long before people came.
And when the first people came, they used fire as their tool.
The program Fire Speaks the Land was written by director of the Co-Motion Dance Project, Karen Kaufman, and her husband, Steve Calling. Kaufman said it all started at Calling's fire lookout in the Clearwater National Forest in Idaho.
We were talking about fire ecology and the role that fire plays in the forest. And it was actually his idea, Steve Calling's idea, to create a dance that would be educational and informative while also being entertaining.
Kaufman is also a professor of dance at the University of Montana. She says they started running this program 3 years ago.
The choreography very much is linked to the narration. We're not pantomiming at all because dance is much more abstract, but there is a direct connection in our minds with the theme, with the movement.
Fire also spreads through conduction.
The dancers use a swaying, flowing movement to move up from a low position until they're reaching up high as a way to show how heat and fire move. Just a little refresher. Conduction, convection, and radiation are ways that heat is transferred. Conduction is through direct contact, convection through gas or liquid, and radiation through electromagnetic radiation.
Some fires are so intense, they throw waves of heat through space, causing objects that aren't even touching the fire to burst into flames.
The dancers bring the audience into the show to illustrate how radiation works. Each dancer does a series of movements, ending with her arms flung out wide to the crowd. The students then mimic the dance, flinging their arms back toward the stage at the end, shooting their energy right back at the dancer. Kaufman says the idea is to help understand concepts through movement.
So we're going past beyond the traditional, more didactic approaches to teaching, and using music and movement and lights and costuming and story to educate.
Elementary school science teacher Lori LePan says she's been working with 6th and 5th graders and kindergartners on fire ecology.
I was thinking about those radiation, convection, those concepts that when I showed them in particular to the kindergartners on a piece of paper, that it really meant nothing to them except they were big multisyllabic words. And now that they've seen them in action, I think we'll be able to go back and talk more about it with better understanding. It also makes me think of ways that I could teach those concepts in the future and make them a little more interactive for the students.
Kaufman says combining the arts and sciences is a good mix.
Very inspiring, both for educators who are excited about teaching in this format, and also to students who are learning things like about convection, conduction, radiation, and science concepts, the fire triangle, fuel, heat, and oxygen, through song and dance.
Kaufman says she and the dancers put together the choreography, and local musicians collaborated on the music. Katrin Fry reporting from Whitefish.
Springtime in Montana brings with it a few certainties. For one, it's going to be muddy. It's also going to be warm and beautiful one day, then snowy and cold the next. It also means bears are starting to wake up and will soon be lumbering out of their dens. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks grizzly bear management biologist Mike Madel conducted his first grizzly bear count of 2014 yesterday on the Rocky Mountain front. In tonight's feature interview, Madel speaks with Edward O'Brien from a remote field station north of Shodo. Madel says there are indications that bears in the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem are now both hibernating and emerging from their dens a little earlier than normal.
And, you know, we're referencing that some to changes in climate over a long period of time. You know, it's a very slow change, but it is, in fact, happening.
And when we say a little bit earlier, what does that mean specifically?
You know, we're talking about a few days to a week earlier in terms of emerging from their dens, and the same in terms of entering their dens. And, you know, that's something that we've been noticing here on the Rocky Mountain front, in particular with global climate change, in that we've been having some really mild springs, which isn't really quite the situation here this spring, but mild springs where the snowpack has left those denning aspects where our grizzly bears generally tend to den. They dig their own dens. They excavate them high in the mountains above 6,000 feet, and the snow covers those dens and insulates them. And as the snow comes off, bears start to emerge a little bit earlier. And this is more of an average year, and we're seeing bears in terms of emergence dates that it's going to be more like an average year of what we used to see 10, 20 years ago.
And when they're denned up, are they out cold for the entire season, or is it they're in and out?
Bears, both grizzly bears and black bears, are in fact true hibernators, but they are able to arouse very quickly and defend themselves within the den or outside of the den. And so although they're not the deep hibernating mammals like ground squirrels might be or marmots, grizzly bears are really out cold. Females do end up waking up and giving birth to cubs in the den, those females that are pregnant. And that, I think I sent you a picture earlier of a female that was in her den, and she actually gave birth to a few cubs. We don't know for sure. We didn't get an observation of them, but we see the little cub tracks outside the den.
How do they nurse?
As soon as the cubs are born, they just pull those cubs in close to them, and they begin to nurse while they're hibernating.
Nature's amazing, Mike.
It really is. You know, bears are an amazing species.
So their priority now for those that are starting to snap out of it is one and only thing, I'm assuming, and that's got to be food.
Right. You know, really what causes bears to start to arouse and emerge is photoperiod, the lengthening days. And bears start to arouse, and they look out the den, they go back in. And a lot of times when we do our first grizzly bear denning flight, we actually can see that bears have come out of the dens and then gone back in and entered back into hibernation. And so that changing photoperiod or day length is really what get them moving. You know, they're in lethargy, so they're not actually hungry. They're just slowly waking up in reference to the changing day length. And a lot of times bears will leave their dens, you know, and bed down in the vicinity of their den for a week or so on a sunny slope and actually be in a torpor condition, and then drop down into lower elevations.
Well, you had quite an interesting day yesterday. Tell us about it.
Well, we did. I fly with a pilot by the name of Rick Geiger, who's with Montana by Air, and he's an excellent pilot. He's been flying on the Rocky Mountain front out of Cutbank for 30 years or so. And we really needed to check out some of these grizzly bear dens, pinpoint the dens, and to see what kind of activity is around the dens. And it was just one of those swirling, cloudy days. And, you know, I've been flying for about 35 years on grizzly bear telemetry flights. And I experienced really some of the most amazing pilot abilities. We got in those clouds into the drainages. And, you know, Rick was just able to fly and pull around those clouds in this Mall 6. It's a small fixed-wing aircraft. And we were able to fly and locate these bears. We did better than we expected, considering the weather conditions.
What'd you see?
You know, we thought maybe we'd be able to fly higher, because when we're able to gain altitude in small aircraft, we can scan further for bears that are radio collared or radio transmitted. So we have some bears that have ear tag transmitters in their ears. And so in all rights, if it were totally clear, we may have gotten more bears and been able to fly a little bit further. But considering the weather conditions, we located 4 adult female grizzly bears. All 4 of those grizzly bears were in their den still. And we observed 1 subadult male. He's a large male that we caught on a research project last year in radio collared. And he was just laying in a day bed on a south-facing sunny slope. He looked very comfortable. And he was laying next to an old deer carcass that he might have been feeding on.
Why would the female still be hibernating, and at least this one particular male, if not exactly up and at him, at least up and lounging a little bit?
Yeah, that's a good question, Edward. It's pretty typical. The adult males and subadult males are really the first to emerge from their dens in the spring. And those females that have yearlings or 2-year-olds might leave next in terms of denning emergence chronology. And then those females that have cubs of the year are last to emerge. And that's a typical thing that most research projects see across the Northern Hemisphere. We see bears that have cubs emerge late, last, because they're, of course, they're nursing their cubs, and they're also protecting those cubs to some degree in the den. And the same thing with den entry. The adult females that are pregnant or those with cubs usually enter their dens earlier, and the adult males are the very last to leave. And you might have heard, you know, in the news last December, there was a grizzly bear that was incidentally captured in a wolf trap in the middle of December on the Rocky Mountain front. And, you know, we handled that bear, released it. He was fine. He wasn't injured. And we radio-collared and released him on the Rocky Mountain front in the middle of December.
Okay, so we've learned here that bears are emerging. Others will be following suit here soon. So this means what for people who are getting in their last turns in the backcountry on their teleskis, or ranchers, or people in the interface? What do we do?
It's a good idea to think now that be more bear aware, that bears are emerging. Bears will be down on low elevation sites and down along trails, so that backcountry users just be cognizant of bear sign tracks. Carry bear spray. Bear spray is a very effective tool in the case of an encounter. And for ranchers, for homeowners, for those that live on the outskirts of Missoula, or for us, Shoto and Dapuyer, to take in your dog food if you've been leaving dog food out on your porch, cat food. Start to think about pulling in your bird feeders and not feeding birds anymore, or make sure that they're hung up at least 10 feet high, you know, so bears can't access those bird feeders. So, you know, think about those attractants that might draw bears in, including livestock feed. That might be, you know, horse cake or grain. Make sure that it's in a bear-resistant container or inside a building, and that the building's closed up.
Right. And if you do happen to see a bear, be it grizz or black, how should you behave so as not to make a bad situation even worse?
You know, generally it is different between grizzly bears and black bears. If you really are aware, hey, I'm looking at a black bear and you're on the trail, it's actually better to make yourself known, to make some noise, and move that bear off. Because black bears generally will run and flee from people. And if a black bear is approaching you, you know, it's generally better to scare it off. If you know you're looking at a grizzly bear, the best thing to do is just stand your ground and not be in a threatened position. If you have bear spray, remove it and have it prepared. Otherwise, if a bear is feeding on a slope, a grizzly bear, back up, move out, and plan an alternate route through an area.
And that applies even if it's a sow with a cub?
Yes. Any female grizzly bear with cubs that you observe, it's really a good idea to back up and move out of that area. Generally, because females tend to be more defensive in protecting their cubs, it's better just to avoid the area altogether and change your plans.
Last question is a pop quiz. Quick, how do you tell a black bear from a grizzly?
Sometimes it can be difficult, but generally a grizzly bear, if you're looking at a bear and you see a high hump, you know, over its shoulders, that's muscle and bone. Grizzly bears dig a lot more than black bears do, but, you know, grizzly bears have a large hump over their shoulders. Even cubs, you can usually define that. And there's a high forehead, or some people call it a dished face, but there's generally a high forehead. Black bears have more of a sloping rostrum or a nose, or some people call it a Roman nose. They have short claws. If you're that close, you can see these longer claws on grizzly bears. And the highest part of their back generally tend to be their rump. Color is not a good way to define bears. Our black bears, especially here on the Rocky Mountain front, can be blonde as grizzly bears.
Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks grizzly bear management biologist Mike Madel, so good talking with you. Always fun to talk with you guys and gals who study bears. What a job you all have.
Thank you so much, Edward. It was really a privilege. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies with rain and lows in the mid-20s to lower 30s. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and snow and highs in the upper 40s to mid-50s. For central Montana tonight, expect partly cloudy skies and a chance of rain and snow with lows 25 to 30 degrees. Tomorrow should be increasing clouds with a slight chance of snow and highs 45 to 55 degrees. For southwest Montana tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies and lows in the 20s. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and highs 45 to 55 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Carrie Hergenberg.
The Montana Energy 2014 Conference and Trade Show wrapped up in Billings today, and attendees learned about many of the opportunities and challenges in developing the abundant energy resources in our state. Oil and natural gas, while perhaps not as abundant in Montana as in Wyoming or North Dakota, represents huge economic potential. But opposition to horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing, coupled with calls for overzealous taxation, casts an ominous shadow over the petroleum industry's future investments in Montana. Wind energy has shown great promise and attracted significant capital investment in parts of the state, but for some reason, the environmental impact studies of proposed wind farms did not accurately predict the effects that massive rotor blades traveling at high rates of speed would have on eagles and other raptors. Consequently, a few environmental groups are now questioning the wisdom of whacking eagles from the sky in order to save a few tons of coal. The largest coal reserves in the world rest within the borders of Montana, but domestic coal-fired power plants are under siege with onerous new EPA emission standards. And global climate change activists are doing everything possible to thwart proposals to export Montana coal to energy-deprived offshore markets. A recent decision by the Washington State Department of Ecology to study the cumulative impacts of a new deep-water port facility as part of their permitting process is hailed by some activists as a landmark victory. Indeed, the decision may prove to be a monumental precedent if the decision stands. The agency apparently intends to not only analyze the potential impact of developing the port facility itself, but to analyze the associated coal mining operations, expanded rail transportation, and the environmental impacts of burning the coal in Asian power plants. Policymakers in Washington State obviously want to make it virtually impossible to mine coal in Montana and transport it to export facilities bound for power plants in China, India, or Korea. Some environmental activists are ecstatic. This is the Holy Grail, the brass ring, the coup de grace. With this precedent, they could blast the environmental review process into infinite space, an orbiting satellite with no return flight path. But as the old adage goes, be careful what you ask for. The next time a so-called green energy project is enthusiastically proposed to supply electricity for the Prius and Tesla cars in Seattle, what's to stop Friends of the Eagle from demanding a cumulative impact study? A new wind farm requires tons of copper for the generators, miles of new aluminum electrical transmission lines, hundreds of tons of concrete, and lots of steel for the towers. Where will the copper, bauxite ore, iron ore, gravel, and limestone be mined? And how will that increased production threaten sensitive and pristine environments somewhere in the world? How will the electricity be generated to turn bauxite ore into aluminum? What about the steel for the towers? Might coal be used in the foundry that produced it? Those icky cement kilns that produce the key ingredient for concrete, will they burn used tires? Uh-oh. Wind farms cause climate change. What about all those high-tech minerals needed to build solar panels and the complex electronics used in the directional control equipment? We better analyze the cumulative impacts of where in South America that stuff comes from, and how it is smelted, and how it is transported to the U.S. If it contributes to climate change, the public has a right to know, and it should be the basis for denying a new solar project. So where does the nonsense end? The availability of non-resident fishing permits induces people to drive gas-guzzling SUVs or fly private jets to Montana. We should probably analyze those cumulative impacts in a full-blown EIS before next year's fishing season. Think of the fossil fuel that could be saved by not inviting people to Montana for a fishing trip. Once the precedent is set, the environmental knife can cut both ways, and it could paralyze the economy if taken to extremes. Bottom line, as a nation and as a state, let's get behind responsible, common-sense energy development that fosters a healthier global economy. More prosperous countries will have the capacity and the political will to invest in environmental protection measures that are beyond their reach today. I'm Kerry Hegreberg with the Montana Contractors Association. Thanks for listening.
Carrie Hegerberg is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.